He was born and raised in Estevan, Saskatchewan, and attended the University of Saskatchewan and later on the University of Toronto. Among his first books of poetry is Black and Secret Man, and later on, An Idiot Joy, then Stony Plain. He's the editor of Contexts of Canadian Criticism and also of an anthology of poets of contemporary Canada. Among his latest publications is Out of Place, and I think he will be reading from some of these books this evening. Mr. Mandel is professor of English and Humanities at York University. He spent 1978 and 79 in Regina as the first Canadian poet in residence of a Canadian city. Isn't that wonderful to have cities, to have poets in residence? Not just universities, we've all heard that, but to have a city have a poet in residence, I think, is wonderful. It brings us back to, what is that, an Elizabethan or an Athenian ideal? Among his awards are the Governor General's Award for Poetry for An Idiot Joy, the Centennial Medal, and the Queen's Silver Jubilee Medal. His new book of criticism, Another Time, collects several of his essays on modern Canadian writing and regional concerns, in which he explores the effect of geography and background on the shaping of a poet's mind, a subject related to his talk tonight entitled The Poet's World. Professor Mandel.
Thank you very much. I must ask, first of all, whether this double microphone is causing any feedback or anything of that kind. Is this coming through clear? Yeah. And I think I should say next that being the poet in residence at Regina, I think, was not only a tribute to Regina, but an ordeal for me. And more than that, a great pleasure for me. It was an extraordinary experience because, of course, I spent a good part of my early years as a boy in Regina, and I ended up in Regina in the library there, where I first, as a boy, used to go and where I began to read those books which so influenced me and determined the direction and character of my career, Tarzan and Doc Savage. I was an ardent fan of the Tarzan series, and I think I read every one of the Tarzan books in the Regina Public Library. I looked up some of them when I was there this last time to see if they still had them, but alas, most of them are gone by now. I don't know quite where. I'm going to talk to you tonight, as the introduction indicated, about a poet's world, and I'm going to do it by means of reading my own poetry and then talking about what my poetry has meant to me and how it relates to the concept of a poet's world. And thinking about what I should say in connection with this topic, I realize it's a very, very difficult topic indeed. While it's true that I've done many, many readings to audiences all across the country, at universities and at schools and in towns, and even in Estevan, Saskatchewan, those readings have been organized around the fact of the reading, not the problem of talking about what poetry is, though that's in fact what one does. And I've been trying to think of how I should organize this talk, and finally I settled upon three words, which are the key words, and which will be the ones that I'll try to give some substance to when I talk to you tonight and when I read certain poems. One word is words, a second word is magic, and a third word is home. And I'm going to try to say something about each of those terms as a means of defining for you what I mean by a poet's world and what poetry is to me and what its significance is, what writing is to me. In the end, those are the words that matter, and I'll try to show you how. I want to begin, though, by talking about, or briefly reading you from, another response to my work, which occurred at Banff when I gave a paper there on region in Canada and the West in American writing. And the response was Professor New's response, Bill New, who's here. He responded to my paper with an opening comment, which I want to read you for two reasons. One is, it's a marvelously amusing and bright comment. It's also one which focuses on, directly, in the most astonishing way, all the kinds of questions I'd like to raise in my talk to you and in my reading of poems this evening. Bill began by saying this, "I have in my possession a photograph of Eli Mandel taken in a bird sanctuary in southern India. The day is bright, the sky is blue, the trees are calm, and Eli is standing, smiling, beside a signpost which reads, 'Look out for crocodiles.' The fact that the sign is ambiguous, it was not intentionally a warning, 'Look out for crocodiles,' but rather a directional indicator to the lookout for crocodiles, only intensifies the point. The comment that it makes on the notions of space and boundary, the terrible ambiguities of location through which we, through which artists identify the kinetic worlds of their own imagination. Now, people are accustomed to seeing, to observing the world. They find in it things they recognize and things they find unfamiliar. But they attempt to make sense of both by interpreting them against a backdrop of their own experience. The indeterminacy of this process raises several immediate questions, like these." And here he touches, it seems to me, on the kinds of questions which I would like to touch upon one way or another as I go through this talk with you tonight and this reading. "To what degree is perception daily distorted by misapprehensions great and small, by the cultural translation through which our minds record and arrange the data that experience provides? What is the nature of the multiple relationship between sociology and culture? Which precedes the other, or do the two grow simultaneously? What is the boundary between accurate and inaccurate perception, and does this matter? Is it the same from person to person, and does that matter? Can one distinguish between a cast of mind that defines external boundaries in order to enfranchise internal space and one that regulates internal attitudes in the assumption that freedom is located in external space? Are boundaries any different from edges? Is space any different from distance? How do culture and individuality both affect language? How does one articulate perceptions, perceiving?" And it's that question, of course, which is the primary one. How does one turn the world into words? Why does one turn the world into words? What a peculiar thing it is to be doing constantly, to be turning the world into words, articulating perceptions, finding language in that way. And Bill goes on, "But I want to go back indirectly by reading to you from one of my favorite essays," giving us an example here, "by James Thurber, which contributes, I think, in its own way to a discussion of place and voice and attitude of mind. The essay is called The French Far West, and Thurber opens it by quoting one of E.M. Forster's observations about film. 'American women,' he says, 'American women shoot the hippopotamus with eyebrows made of platinum.' I have given that remarkable sentence," he says, "a great deal of study." And well, he might. I, too, have given that sentence a great deal of study. That is what poetry is about. American women shoot the hippopotamus with eyebrows made of platinum. It's the problem of what can happen in words themselves, with language itself. The sentence focuses the very first question that I want to talk about. And I'm going to talk about this sentence, words, by showing you, by reading a poem here, what it is that a poet, like myself, begins with, words. In this case, I have a found poem. That is to say, words on a page written by someone else. And what I've done is isolated these words and I present them to you as a poem. I isolate them by framing them, by giving them a structure, a frame, a border, and that makes them into a poem. Now the poem that I'm going to read, the found poem that I'm going to read, in fact wasn't found by me. It was found by my daughter when we were in Spain, and it's called First Political Speech. What my daughter found was a list of transition words, a grammatical list in a text that she was studying when she was in Spain and she was going through her English course there, the extension course that she was studying while we were in Spain on a sabbatical. And she came across this list of words, first political speech. And she came to me and she said, "Daddy, this is a poem." And I looked at it and I thought, if I read you a list of transitional words, it's not a poem. But if I read you a political speech, you'll recognize it as a poem immediately. Words become poetry simply by the transformation which occurs through the title, the framing, the bordering that goes on here. And I suppose it's kind of appropriate tonight that you should be asked to listen to a political speech first of all. I'm not telling you which party is speaking. I don't think it really matters. You'll recognize that it could be any one of at least four parties. First political speech goes like this. First, in the first place, to begin with. Secondly, in the second place, lastly. Again, also, in the next place, once more, moreover, furthermore, likewise, besides, similarly, for example, for instance, another. Then, nevertheless, still, however, at the same time, yet in spite of that, on the other hand, on the contrary, certainly, surely, doubtless, indeed, perhaps, possibly, probably, anyway, in all probability, in all likelihood, at all events, in any case, therefore, consequently, accordingly, thus as a result, in consequence of this, as might be expected, the foregoing, the preceding, as previously mentioned, as already stated. Well, poetry begins with words. Words turn into poems in very, very strange and very peculiar ways. And throughout my life as a poet, what I've been concerned with is words. I've been concerned as well with magic. And magic means for me three things. I'm going to say more about this later on, but first of all, I will say it means misdirection. A magician, as Robertson Davies points out, is an expert at misdirection, at making the audience look the other way while he does things in this with this hand over here. The left hand makes you look that way while the right hand does what matters. It's concerned with what's called synchronicity, something that's quite wonderful and which brings two things together in very striking and coincidental ways, And it's concerned also with transformation, with that change that occurs when words become poems. Poems transform things. Years ago, I wrote a poem which is called Houdini, because Houdini, of course, was a master magician and escape artist. And in a book called An Idiot Joy, which has been mentioned, I write about Houdini. And the point is that I write about him as an escape artist who's escaping from language, so that words and magic come together in this poem. The magician is caught by words and escapes from words, transforming words into the devices by which his escape art becomes an art. Houdini, I suspect he knew that trunks are metaphors, could distinguish between the finest rhythms unrolled on rope or singing in a chain, and knew the metrics of the deepest pools. I think of him listening to the words spoken by manacles, cells, handcuffs, chests, hampers, roll-top desks, vaults, especially the deep words spoken by coffins. Escape, escape. Quaint Harry in his suit, his chains, his desk, attached to all attachments, how he'd sweat in that precise struggle with those binding words wrapped around him like that mannered style, his formal suit, and spoken when? By whom? What thing first said there's no way out, so that he'd free himself, leap, squirm, no matter how, to chain himself again, once more jump out of the deep, alive, with all his chains singing around his feet, like the bound crowds who sigh, who sigh. I was fascinated by magicians and magic and circuses and all those images of wonder and transformation, which means so much to a boy and so much to a poet. I wrote a poem, for example, to my wife when she was the girl that I was courting, to use that old-fashioned phrase that we used in those days. And it's called Girl on a High Wire, in which I imagine her as a tightrope walker up on the wire, and I'm looking up at her at a circus, and I invite her to leap into my arms. And this is the poem, Girl on a High Wire. Do you think I'd sit here staring if I knew how to invent chairlifts or lacked this odd taste for vertigo? What if I dare you to jump, saying, ah, my hurt bird, I will catch you. And if I weren't there, someone calling, my son pointing at camels or wanting to pee when your eyes became horizons. Or if you fell into the well of bankers, midwives, my brother-in-law, the Prudential Life Insurance Company, I see them, heroine, hefting you, their applause ringing your head with the clatter of zircons, mouths blowing little balloons of praise. The great globe circles. Soldiers fall into muddy rivers. Boys walk the tightropes of their prison yard. I can no longer look at telephone wires, the vanishing point of your unfinished portrait. I shall devote myself to entomology, practice weightlifting with dinky toys, but who will keep me from my crooked prayers, these mad doves that fling halos around you? And so poetry was for me throughout, you know, the world of the circus, the world of magic, the world of transformation, the world of tricks with language. We went to Spain, and we went to Spain in 1972. In 1972, I wrote a book, which is called Stony Plain, And I'm going to keep track of the time here. I intended to read you some poems from that because there are poems about Spain, but I'll just tell you this part of the story because it's a very important part of the story which moves into the book that I want to talk about most of all tonight, a book about place and about the problem of the poet and place and perception and words and place, how the world turns into words, how words turn into the world. When we were in Spain, we lived in a little village, a fishing village, on the Mediterranean coast, on the side of a mountain, looking out to the sea. And I was obsessed all the time as I looked across those red hills, those barren hills, with the notion that I was in Estevan, Saskatchewan. Now, how can that be? You know, Estevan is in the middle of this continent. It's 1,000 miles from the sea in any direction. It's on a flat plain, though there's a valley, the Souris Valley, and there are hills around it as well, down below the town, and it goes into the big muddy badlands. But I was obsessed by the idea that I was in Spain, that in Spain I was in Estevan. And I said to Anne at that time, how can this be? Why do I keep remembering this landscape of Estevan when we're in the mountains by the Mediterranean Ocean? And I made up my mind then that when we returned from Spain, we would go back from Toronto, where we lived at the time, to Estevan, and we would visit that landscape again. And we would go back to my home. There was something about the idea of home which was calling to me. And I would find out what this echo in myself was. And indeed, that's what happened. And the consequence of that was the book Out of Place. But first of all, while we were in Spain, I wrote a poem which is in Out of Place. I reprinted the poem later on. It's called Estevan 1934. I wrote it because I was remembering Estevan during that time. And the Estevan that I was remembering was the Estevan of the drought years, of the years when cattle were dying, and when our family was very poor indeed. And we were a Jewish family in a small town in Saskatchewan, which was falling apart, as so many places were. And the poem was called Estevan 1934. What I remembered, which engineered the poem for me, was that my mother had once said that I was not to play with the family we called Breeds, that is Métis, La Roque their name was. And I wrote this poem at that time, Estevan 1934. Remembering the family we called Breeds, the Rocks, their house smelling of urine, my mother's prayers before the dried fish, she cursed them for their dirtiness, their women I remember too, how seldom they spoke and they touched one another. Even when the sun killed cattle and rabbis, even in the poisoned slow air, like hunters, like lizards, they touched stone, they touched earth. Now, there's a kind of magic in that poem which I became aware of when I returned to Canada, and I discovered that the Cree people, in fact, have a saying, which is well known, because there's a CBC broadcast, for example, which uses this saying of theirs, touch the earth. And it turns out that I used that phrase not knowing what it meant. And it works exactly, because the phrase means, we are the people. We call ourselves in this way, we touch the earth, you don't. You walk in your shoes, we walk on our feet, we touch the earth. Also means other things like that. Well, I began to work on a book, which was a book about the return to Estevan, Saskatchewan. Anne and I went across the country by train to Edmonton. We took a car from Edmonton, we drove across the prairies, and we drove to Estevan. We went back and looked at the house where I was born. We looked at the town. And I said to Anne, we must go further. We have to go further back. We have to go back to where the family was, where my grandfather comes from Hirsch, Saskatchewan. Grandfather was a Jewish rabbi. He was a teacher. He was the mayor of this little town. And he was also one of the directors of the great colonization which occurred on the prairies. He was one of the ones who guided Jewish immigrants across the prairies to the very places that they had to go and find a place to build a farm. The Hoffer family, for example, who built a farm in a town called Hoffer, Saskatchewan. And we drove out to Hoffer, Saskatchewan, across the Big Money Badlands. We had been to Hirsch, and we couldn't find my grandfather's farm, by the way. It was gone. But we went out to Hoffer, Saskatchewan, and there in Hoffer, we discovered what is in this book. There are photographs, which Anne has taken. They're photographs of a ghost town, a Jewish ghost town. It's probably the only Jewish ghost town in North America, but you know, that's just by the way. It's a ghost town. It's an old Jewish colony which is now deserted. What remains of it is a ruined house, a ramshackle house. There are many such towns in Saskatchewan. And that's a photograph. I don't know whether you could see it there at all. You can see there's an old frame house, and there's a field with an overturned Quebec heater and an iron bedstead lying in it. And this remarkable thing, which we discovered, which is a huge vault, a brick or cement vault on a ridge. In that vault, the papers of the colony still lay on the ground, untouched after all those years, blowing about in the little wind that blew in from the prairies, but not out of the vault. And we looked at this deserted place. I felt spooked there, as a matter of fact. And we went on from there. We drove to Wood Mountain, and from Wood Mountain back to Estevan, and the pilgrimage was complete, and I began to write the book. And I couldn't write the book. I wrote certain poems of the book for a while. I'm going to read you some of those. They're called The Return. But I had great difficulty putting these in the book until something happened, which I'll tell you about after I read you some of the poems called The Return. These are poems which I worked on and reworked after I'd finished the book, The Return. In the Estevan poem, for example, how everyone can be seen eating, or is it reading? But not everyone. There's myself in the Souris Valley 40 years later, Anne looking at wildflowers, cactus, their thick colors. I remember how I dreamt her, pale as a flower in the white sun. And in the dream, she is taking pictures. She photographs me walking away along a curving path, the flowers colored, and my father appears, my mother appears, saying no words, troubled, and all the ghostly Jews of Estevan praying in the synagogue of the valley in the covenant of coal mines in these pictures of Estevan. And I went on trying to reformulate the lost memory of the lost town I'd been in. I wrote poems about perception, about doors of perception. I wrote about my birthmark. Here's one of those wonderful pieces of synchronicity which comes together. I have a birthmark here. This white patch of hair, less noticeable now that it's become whiter all over, but once that was very, very strikingly white. And of course, a birthmark is called a mouse, and the story goes that I got that birthmark because my mother saw a mouse when she was pregnant with me. And she said, oi, when she saw a mouse. And she struck her forehead. And she said, he's going to have a mark when he's born. And I was born with the birthmark. So I wrote the poem. And of course, you realize there are connections that are just profound in this. Estevan is on, built on the top of a hill beside the valley, which is called the Souris Valley. The Souris, you recognize, is French for mouse. The Souris River is the Mouse River. And so I wrote this poem. As soon as I suddenly thought of birthmark, the mark on my forehead, seeing a mouse, my mother struck her temple. He'll be marked at birth, she said. The women cried. I carry the Souris on my brow, the river in my head. The valley of my dreams still echoes with her cry. And then there are poems about Souris River and so on. And then a poem like this, which is here on the prairies, leaving him with five children. And they became my step-uncles and step-aunts. Grandfather Berner married my present grandmother. And this graveyard is deserted now. It's a Jewish cemetery near Hirsch. Anne is taking pictures again while I stand in the uncut grass counting the graves. There are 40, I think. The Hebrew puzzles me. The wind moving the grass over the still houses of the dead. From the road, a muffled occasional roar, cars passing. No one there casts a glance at the stone trees, the unliving forest of Hebrew graves. In the picture, I stand, arms outstretched, as if waiting for someone. I am in front of the gates. You can see the wind here, the grass always bending, the stones unmoved. And Rabbi Berner's farm, I wrote about that. I wrote about slaughterhouse, a memory too. Grandfather, who was also a shochet, that is to say, a ritual slaughterer. After the morning in the slaughterhouse, grandfather leading me back to the kitchen, the farm unpainted, weathered, grandmother milking guts of shit for skins and kishka. It's no place for boys, she says, her face redder than strawberries, her hands like cream. Lost place. In the book of years, Berner told me could be found your own name exactly spelled, his own, his son's, the Russian names of villages and Jews, 12 strangled ducklings, laughter in bed. You were written. I read the land for records now. Wild strawberries, cocoa butter, taste of Hirsch, bags of curdling, warm, spent streams, tested on a hair of Berner's beard, the ritual slaughter knife. Even the blood has disappeared. There's one other poem. There are many more which I could read from this section, but there's one other poem that I want to read you because it's got a good deal to do with the story of this voyage. When I was finished with the book, I talked about it on CBC, and after I talked about it at one time, I got a note, a letter. I've got permission to read you the letter. It's a remarkable letter. 647 Maple Drive, Weyburn, Saskatchewan, April the 7th, 1975. Professor Eli Mandel, English Department, York University, Toronto, Ontario. Dear Professor Mandel, heard you on This Country in the Morning and was more than surprised when you mentioned that your new book on poetry and prose will be about the Jewish colony of Hofer, or Sonnenfeld Colony, which is the correct name. Whereas my husband and I were both born in the colony and are still carrying on farming operations there and have a great interest in the area, we are wondering where you got your information. It was interesting to hear you say that your wife has been out taking pictures. Would it be possible to know of this? And when and where do you plan to have your book published? We would like to buy it when it becomes available. Thank you. Yours truly, Mrs. N. Feldman. Well, when I got that letter, needless to say, I was shocked. That was Hoffer, Saskatchewan, that ghost town, not Sonnenfeld, or so I believed. What did this letter mean? And I wrote a poem called Sonnenfeld. Mrs. Feldman writes to tell me I've got my ghosts all wrong. It isn't Hoffer, she says. I look again at our photographs, fading pastels, grainy texture, as if it happened long ago. Mrs. Feldman, I say to myself softly, I can't see you in the picture. There's no one there. Were we in the wrong place? Who is mistaken? What can your letter possibly mean? Its words in pale blue ink, copied carefully as a will or a schoolteacher's correction about a bad essay on the geography of the West. When we were in Bordeaux, France, the summer before this, I received another letter from Esther Hoffer, the daughter of Israel Hoffer, who founded the colony of Hoffer. And she said, Eli, I must tell you how deeply moved I am to see your book with the photographs of our house. I can remember playing in the very corner of the field in that picture that you have. Tell your wife how much I love the pictures. Incidentally, do you remember, she said, I used to live in your house when I was in grade 12 in Estevan, Saskatchewan. And the letter was signed, and the address was two houses down the street from Mrs. Feldman. I have a dream, which is that one day I will go to Weyburn, Saskatchewan, and I will see these two ladies, each 67 or 68 years old now, and I'm going to say to them, which one of you is right? Is it Hoffer or is it Sonnenfeld? Can you tell me the answer to that question? As a matter of fact, I was in Weyburn this last winter, and I wanted to go to see them, but I couldn't. There wasn't time. I had to go on to Estevan, where I read poetry that day. Now, there's one other thing to tell you as part of this story, and it's a remarkable thing, and it's part of the story of the magic and part of the story of the meaning of this this book, and it's a true story, too. I had trouble finishing the book. I couldn't put it together. I couldn't structure it. I didn't have an order for it. And the poems seemed to me random, and I couldn't focus them. We went to Banff, and at Banff, one afternoon, Anne and I and my son Charles and my daughter Sarah were swimming at the old cave and basin. And I got out of the water first, and I stood by the edge of the pool, and I looked up. There's a walkway across the top of the pool on the other side. And I looked up, and I saw a man come out and walk to the edge of that walkway and lean over the edge and look down and wave at me. And I realized with a tremendous start, the hair stood up on the back of my head, that I was looking at myself, that I was seeing my double. Not someone who looked like me, but someone who was me. That's exactly what I felt. In fact, I said to Anne, when she and Sarah came out of the water, can you see that man up there? And she said, I don't see anyone up there. Who's up there? And Sarah, the little girl, said, I see someone. He looks just like you, Daddy. But the fact of the resemblance isn't important. The feeling, which is a very familiar one to poets, of seeing one's double, was the important thing. Now, of course, the double is a familiar figure in literature. and in, among poets and among artists. Schubert has got the Doppelganger songs, and Dostoevsky has written about a double, and Shelley has written about a double, and Byron has written about it. It's an infinite number of writers and musicians who've been concerned with this. Now, the significance of seeing your double is that it's an omen that you're going to die very, very shortly. You realize that I was alarmed by this vision, this apparition. And for a long while, I was quite moody about it, from July until January of the next year. It was in January that I was preparing a lecture on fantasy, and this is where magic comes into the whole story, at York University, in a course on fantasy, and I was going to write about the Argentinian writer Jorge Luis Borges, and I thumbed idly through some of his books. Borges has a book on called The Book of Imaginary Beings, and there's a section on the double. And he says there, you can read it for yourselves, to see your double is a common experience among poets and others. He's called the fetch in Irish, for example. He's called the doppelganger in German. He's got an Egyptian name, and so on and so on. And he invariably, in all cultures, signifies the immediate onset of death. Is an omen of imminent death for all cultures except for Jews. With enormous relief, I sat down and wrote a brilliant lecture on Borges. But it was only later, the next summer, that suddenly it occurred to me what had happened, that I had been given a message. What, in fact, did Borges say the doppelganger means to Jews, if not the onset, the immediate onset of death, the omen of imminent death? He means the immediate onset of prophetic power. And I knew that I could finish the book of poems. And what I did was write a series of double poems. And I'm going to conclude the reading itself by reading you some of the double poems that I wrote, which organize the whole book, and then I'm going to read you a short prose piece that I wrote, and when I finish that, I'll be finished, and we can talk to one another about the kinds of questions this raises. Seems to me it does. See, the double appears in the book, and he's a kind of sinister figure. He raises certain questions for me. I understand that he's sinister, but I understand that he's a definition, too, that he's a kind of id figure, or he's a kind of wicked figure who gives me messages, who makes poetry possible, who offers all kinds of things to me. And so we hear him in the first poem. The point of view is the point of view of the double, though the syntax is not that way. But you have to understand that essentially he's speaking, or the message is about him. And he says very strange things. The doppelganger, ways to prevent me. Refusing to be interrupted, especially by children. Single-mindedness to the point of brutality in all matters of politics, religion, metaphysics, and the character and lives of your closest friends. Praising the worst lines of your fellow writers. Jogging followed by volleyball and cold showers. Concentrated masturbation before and after sex. Sleeping with a towel knotted in your back. Inspired teaching, ferocious tactics in Romoli, combinations of alcohol, Librium, and bad novels. Seeing I'm here, you know all methods fail. You don't even know how long it has been. What I might have said to your children or others, now it's forever too late. No one could possibly know you've been gone for days. When I make love to your wife, she will moan and praise you, asking you never to leave. Where shall I say you have gone? And this is called There are several kinds of double poems here, but this is Questions a Double Asks, and these are again, complex in point of view, but simple. They're the questions that are implied by the double himself, and then I'll finish the reading part with the double world, a speculation about doubles. Questions a Double Asks. Whether anything in your dreams accounts for his appearing now. How it is explanations of acute anxiety do not suffice to dispel him. What in your philosophical readings could be consistent with the notion of reduplication? Whether he is a refutation of clock time and a way to justify eternity. Why you're afraid of him as shown by your blood pressure and pulse. Does his appearance improve your sexual performance? Has the government of Canada, Ontario, Alberta significantly changed because of his presence? What explanations can you offer your father, your department chairman, the Department of Revenue? Give a detailed account of all sadomasochistic fantasies you entertain. Refer to each scatological childhood incident, coprophilia, necrophilia, sodomy. Do you know yourself? Have you any reason for hope or delight? Why do you think I'm here? Will you change your life? Account for the difference between the spider and the spider plant. Have you considered the fern, the coleus, the philodendron, the patience plant, the flowers, the hoya, the lilies of the day, the ants, bees, sweetness, light, the sun, the moon? Why are you writing out these questions? Will you do nothing to help me? Is poetry all you have to offer? And this is the double world. It's a speculation about the two worlds. And Anne appears, my grandfather Burner, Annie Burner, who's the one who died and is in the graveyard in Hirsch, and our trip to Wood Mountain. At Wood Mountain, we saw petroglyphs, that is to say, carved signs that have been carved by nobody knows who carved them, the native people. They're very ancient signs and very strange signs. We saw them in the rock. What was written in the land? That was the question that suddenly came to me. What was written in the land? What words are in the land that we live in? The double world. It is variously believed that this world is the double of another, as in Plato, Swedenborg, Malebranche, some of Immanuel Kant, Arthur C. Clarke, Isaac Asimov, Stanley Kubrick. Two clocks set at the same time in identical universes should stop at the same time. This clock is a shadow of that real clock. When I look at my clock, I have no way of knowing whether I am in the first or second universe. It is spring there, too, and the other Anne has grown an avocado, exactly the same height, greenness, number of leaves as the one Anne grew here or there. My grandfather Burner weighed the same in both universes, sang sweet Jewish psalms, ate sour curds. In the two graveyards, Annie Burner is dead. Nothing on either prairie changes, though the winds blow across immensities your heart would shrivel to imagine, knowing they pass between the worlds and can be heard to do so on the road to Wood Mountain. That is what was written in the rocks. And now I'm going to finish this by reading you a brief prose meditation. It's a meditation, essentially, as you'll realize right away. It's called Beginnings, and I finish with Beginnings. It's about words, magic, place, as it relates to my poetics, about it's an account of what poetry means to me in the terms in which I've talked about it tonight. And I'll read this to you. It refers to some of the poems I've read and certainly the concerns that I have been talking about tonight. Beginnings, music, sound, an irritant, something way below the line, below the stanza, below the image, a possibility, all possibilities, a blank page, a second chance, the first line, the intrigue of beginning, to cheat or not, writing as rewriting, each new line another line to rewrite biography, each poem a new biography, a biography anew. Bony literalist, I try to read out of a skeleton of alphabets the whole body that is, was me. Archaeologist of the word, attempting to reconstruct whole lives from the fossil poem. Music, sound, something below the line, the word, the place, though a time and timing of self, its rhythms. Somewhere, Clark Blaze says, stories are interested in beginnings, not endings. Genesis, not apocalypse. My own preference has been endings, bringing the house down. And so it's difficult to go back to when the house was there and all stories, poems were possible. Nothing had yet fallen. Now I am reading Carl Sagan's The Dragons of Eden, perhaps because he writes of dragons and dreams, or perhaps because he, along with Paul Drake, make an appearance in one of the poems of Stony Plain, because Sagan and Drake sound to me very much like a science fiction team, or because, in fact, they designed the language plaque for Pioneer 10, words for any being anywhere. Anybody out there? Clues for a human language. There's a first poem, and it says man and woman, and it says earth, household, and it says figure it out. In the poem, a Pioneer 10 returns from outered space, outer limits, carrying the same message from one Sagan Drake to another, again, duplication, mirror images, a beginning. Out there, as far as it can go, imagination begins to curve back upon itself, where it begins, in a mirror reflecting a mirror reflection. Reflections. Do we remember being born? Before birth? Lies my mother told me. Grandfathers of my name where the Cossacks rode. Pogroms of yesteryear in Ukrainian fields. The dragons of Eden tell us not about out there, but in here, the evolution of human intelligence, beginnings. The triune brain is one part reptile, one part animal, one part human. My poems, I begin to think, begin in the reptile brain, which is as it should be for anyone who lived his earliest years beside the Souris Valley in Saskatchewan. Now I begin to understand why it was, hearing the rumored news of giant beasts in the valley, I confused hoodoo with dinosaur. Neanderthal, Cro-Magnon man walked the hills of Ross Percy, explored slate and coal caves below Estevan. The world took form for me in the pictures and charts I read, pored over, traced in H.G. Wells' The History of the World, at least until the time history began. Then it got dull. Reptilian Valley, where I dreamed myself in Mesozoic times. Now driving home along the 401 in Toronto, November, it will snow today or tomorrow. Looking at the strongly contrasting light and dark of the sky, my friend recalls Maple Creek. Everything on the prairies is melodramatic, he says. It sounds right to me, and images come together then. Darkening sky, a blackness not to be believed, portent of three more days of a dust blizzard, skeletons of cattle and fields of stubble, the sound of weeping in the night, the end of the world. So it seemed. In the 30s, one heard everywhere about endings, disappearing farms, business failures, crop failures. Goodbye, grandfathers. Goodbye, uncles. Goodbye, Savemore. No more my father's store. We load some canned goods on a horse-drawn wagon, squeak and grumble to a green clapboard house at the edge of the valley. The horizon disappears. The world begins to begin elsewhere. Reruns. The uncanny begins with substitution. That may be the most powerful human capability. I learn slowly the connections of failure, ritual, magic, redundancy, reduplication. A boy much given to thinking out substitute worlds. The Universal Baseball Association, Eli Mandel, proprietor. A stick and a stone at the edge of the valley, replaying the replayed World Series on a wall of the Leader Post building. The map of Paris and an old red atlas that is Paris, at the center of the world, inside the world, is the world. Displacement. It's a dream method. A displaced person adds a new word to the language, DP. I see my uncle's hands at the typewriter as he types a sentence in which all the letters of the alphabet locate themselves. The quick brown fox jumped over the lazy dog. When I am 13, I begin to understand reading. Doc Savage possesses me. Compelled necessities, the daily Hebrew prayer, the phylacteries that threaten to bind me in mere repetition. It is not until 1944, in a Quonset hut in Normandy, that I begin to reinvent myself. At first in a penguin history of Nelson's battles, then in maps of Russian tank wars, maps, the X on the floor, the cricketer's placement, chess middles, endings, beginnings, later in a reconverted hospital in Watford, England, the books of Hardy, Houseman, Owen, Yeats, Kafka, Dostoevsky, Spender, Auden, Day-Lewis. The spiritual project is virtually complete, the substitute world working itself out. On the road to Estevan in 1946, inventing apocalypses, I understand the possibility of poetry, its commands. I begin to write until I have written The Death of Icarus, His Father, My Father, Orpheus, The Destruction of Estevan, and have published my first book, Beginnings. Almost a quarter of a century later, that early madness still surprises me. It has been made sensible in a collection like Crusoe, but I know it can't be explained away. Too much belief went into it. On the road to Estevan in 1946, poems began in my attempt to displace the past, to substitute another world for the possible world. 40 years later, I find myself on that road once again, still trying to find beginnings. Thank you.
I'll answer questions now.
Okay. Professor Mandel has agreed to answer questions. Please keep them short and distinct and speak loudly enough so that Professor Mandel can repeat the question. Yes? Excuse me, I recognized somebody here first.
Would you be good enough to give me your definition of the difference between poetry and prose?
The question is, would I be good enough to give this perceptive lady an answer to the demanding question, give my distinction between poetry and prose? The answer is, I don't know. I don't think it can be answered. I mean that quite seriously.
Do you have a question, sir? Yes.
I would like to ask the doctor, what poet's works inspired you the most? Or did you rely mostly on thought?
On which? Well, the question you may have heard is whether or not I'm a dope fiend or a poet. And the answer is the poets who inspired me most I named in that piece that I just read you. Wilfred Owen is one of the very earliest. Houseman, believe it or not. Thomas Hardy. Certainly the contemporary poets in my time, C.D. Lewis. And Stephen Spender and W.H. Auden, and I think William Butler Yeats most of all. Probably among Canadian poets, Ray Souster and Irving Layton. Pot I have very, very seldom had at all. And as someone remarked recently, I puff it, I don't inhale it.
Go ahead.
Excuse me, I speak little English. I like to make one question. Is this, I come in North America 1 month before in United States and 3 days before in Vancouver. I like to come here, I listen to this conference. My question is this. I think the best poetry in North America is Walt Whitman. I like listen a literary commentary for Walt Whitman for you.
This is a very interesting question in which this young man has said he has just come here. He barely speaks English. He has been in the United States. He has spent 3 days in Vancouver, is that correct? And has just come here. He's interested in a conference like this. He thinks the best poetry in North America is Walt Whitman's.